Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, April 14th, welcome, 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 friends. On Into the Program, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Great to have you here today, Kevin. And today on Studio 2, we have our political roundtable back, and there is a lot to talk about. The U.S. has launched a naval blockade of Iranian ports after peace talks collapsed. But now there are hints that diplomacy could restart before the ceasefire expires. We'll break that down as far as what's happening in those negotiations. We'll also talk about what is at stake globally with regard to the Strait of Hormuz in play. Also, back here at home, President Trump is facing backlash after attacking Pope Leo. President Trump posted and then deleted an AI-generated image of himself as a Christ-like figure. There's a whole bunch of stuff. And then, of course, there were elections abroad. And there's, of course, rising gas prices and inflation. So we've got two great guests to help walk us through all of these issues. We have a political reporter. We also have a national security reporter. And, of course, we have you, our friends, listening at home, on the road, or elsewhere. Our question of the day is, what questions do you have about the major political headlines today? What news stories are you following most closely? What are you most concerned about? You can give us a call. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook streamers, you can put your comments in the chat.
Yeah, news cycle just keeps moving, Cherry.
Chugging away.
One of those weekends where just stuff keeps popping up on your timeline, in your group chat. We were over at the University of Pennsylvania Law School yesterday doing our live show about the history of the Supreme Court. So we thought today would be a great day to jump back in and give the Philadelphia region a chance to call us, get in their comments, their thoughts.
And I know
all
people have comments.
Big national, international stories that are happening. Before we get to that, a trio of local news stories, Cherry, including our first story, where legislation is moving in Philadelphia City Council that aims to put restrictions on federal immigration and customs law enforcement. So this is a seven-bill package that would prohibit ICE from wearing face masks, using unmarked vehicles, and making stops and arrests on city-owned properties during raids in Philadelphia. The bills would also restrict city agencies from sharing data or collaborating with ICE and prohibit discrimination based on immigration or citizenship status in Philadelphia. So the bills passed the Committee of the Whole yesterday, and that's a kind of a key legislative step. Before then, it would get a big full vote in City Council. Proponents are saying these are important steps to make Philadelphia a welcoming city. Mayor Sherelle Parker's administration has been a little, it's been unclear exactly what their position was until they testified in some of these hearings, where they say there's parts of this package we absolutely support, and there's others that we feel, quote, have some legally problematic language in reference to some of the jurisdictional issues. Mm-hmm. And would the city really have the authority to make these rules compared to what the feds can do and on which properties, et cetera. So it's another example of, I think, the Parker administration trying to walk this tightrope when it comes to federal immigration enforcement in the city of Philadelphia. And it's just, it's the latest in that. And it seems like this package of bills will pass.
Yeah. Proponents of the bill packed City Hall yesterday. So there's a lot of political pressure to do this. But Mayor Sherelle Parker's administration, as you said, she's played it safe on the immigration issue. Her lawyers pointed out a lot of the stuff in these bills are already covered by executive orders that have been in place for years. And so, you know, they're like, okay, you want to codify it, that's fine. But I think the lawyers are also paying attention to the fact that just over the bridge in New Jersey, the Trump administration sued the Sherrill administration over her executive order that prohibited ICE operations from happening on certain types of property. And they've asserted, you know, the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution. So they're probably a little nervous about that. You know, the Parker administration, if they're going to get in a legal battle like they did with the president's house, they want to be able to win. And so they're kind of reluctant, I think, to get in a battle where around jurisdictional issues, especially if there's questions about whether or not they have the upper hand on it.
Right. And given everything that we've seen in Minneapolis, other cities across the country, I think the Parker administration strategy has been, don't go out of your way to poke the Trump administration on this. So far, you can argue that that has worked.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so story number two, going back over the bridge, North Jersey and South Jersey are battling once again over who gets to have casinos in the Garden State. Interesting story in the Philadelphia Inquirer about the brewing turf war that started after New York City approved three casinos to open in the Big Apple. In response, some North Jersey legislators have started a push to open a casino in North Jersey. They want to keep gambling dollars from going over the bridge, the northern part of the bridge, to New York City. And this, Kevin, is not the first time this debate has bubbled to the surface. The question of whether casinos should be allowed outside of Atlantic City came up about a decade ago, and voters overwhelmingly answered no. But one of the guys behind the push to bring casinos to North Jersey again is State Senator Vin Gopal, who just so happened to have chaired Mikey Sherrill's gubernatorial campaign. So pundits are wondering how she'll handle it if she has to play referee. As she has promised to be an ally to South Jersey, but then, you know, a lot of her allies are in North Jersey. So everybody's going to kind of wait and see what happens.
And it's just so interesting, the larger context of all this, right? You have Atlantic City as this economy that was built and propped up on gambling and casinos. And over the past 20, 30 years, has just been kind of eroded as that market has gone everywhere else, including Pennsylvania, right? Like Pennsylvania strategically said, we can start to generate revenue, we think, tax revenue from these casinos if we allow them to occur, and we can steal customers essentially from Atlantic City. And we've seen that happen in Pennsylvania. So many casinos popped up in our region. And this question in New Jersey has been, well, are we going to allow the same thing to happen, essentially to cannibalize that market in Atlantic City? Just fascinating.
Yeah. And what's also interesting is they're also competing with these cell phones.
Right. Well,
because, you know, New Jersey did open the door to sports gambling. And a lot of people do that right from home. So people don't have to go to casinos anymore. Right. And then you got casinos opening over the south to the south in Philly and Pennsylvania. You got them now coming in the north. And so do you expand and then further, jeopardize Atlantic City, which has been this hub and has been struggling for the past few years? So we'll see.
It's like Philadelphia is one thing, and now New York City, it's a whole different existential threat to New Jersey's economy.
It's a whole nother thing. Yeah.
All right. Story three. You think about the Philadelphia soul, the music movement of the 1970s, you might conjure the names Gamble and Huff, Teddy Pendergrass, the OJs, producer Tom Bell. Well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week is shining a spotlight on a lesser known Sound of Philadelphia pioneer, Linda Creed, who is getting a citation in the musical excellence category. So Creed, I got to admit, I did not know her before today when I read this story, was a Germantown High grad who became the songwriter behind many hits of the era, especially for the stylistics, including You Make Me Feel Brand New, Stop, Look, and Listen, I'm Stone in Love with You. Creed was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 26, continued to write. And what would become her best known song came out of that struggle. It's a song about staying strong through all of life's challenges. Originally recorded by George Benson, but became a number one hit for Whitney Houston in 1986, just weeks after Linda Creed died at age 37. That song, Al, hit it.
I'm just so sad that Linda Creed did not live long enough to see this song, Greatest Love of All, make it to number one. But I'm so glad she made the song. And I have to say that this was the first little single that I got as a kid, right? And I played it on my little pink boombox as a kid. And this was the song that all the kid choirs sang during the 80s. This was the song. And so I'm so happy that she is being honored in this way. And by the way, she was honored in Philadelphia when she got her star on the Walk of Fame back in 1990. So we've sown home love, but national love That's huge.
It's so cool that she's getting her due. And of course, like, you know, this is such a massive hit and a huge song. And you feel the energy and the heart behind it. I never knew the story behind the song. So cool that Linda Creed's song is really getting its due. And she's getting her due by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
And we're going to let y'all listen to a little bit more because it's just that good. And by the way, we have our political roundtable coming up after this break. But we gotta go out on some Whitney.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Kevin McCrory in for Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we are doing a politics roundtable with two great reporters who can help us wade through a flurry of news, both abroad and at home. The U.S. launched its naval blockade of Iran ports yesterday after weekend peace talks broke down around a nuclear moratorium and the fighting in Lebanon.
While back at home, President Trump is facing backlash for his attack on Pope Leo and an AI-generated image depicting himself as a Christ-like figure. The behavior is causing more people to voice concerns about his focus on the issues Americans care about most, especially the high cost of living.
And we'll get into all of that, plus lessons from Hungary's election and the latest midterm outlook with our two guests. And let me introduce them. We have Molly Ball, a political reporter and author working on a book about realignment. She was the Wall Street Journal senior political correspondent. Molly, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We also have Missy Ryan, a staff writer for The Atlantic who covers national security. Missy, so happy to have you here today.
And we always want to hear from our audience. What news stories are you following most closely and what are you most concerned about? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email us, studio2@whyy.org. If you're following along on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And we wanted to start with the negotiations or non-negotiations happening around the war in Iran. And so, Missy, can you give us the clearest picture of where things stand right now? Are these U.S.-Iran talks actually alive, or is it something else?
I think there's a possibility for the talks to resume. They broke off over the weekend in Islamabad, Pakistan, with no agreement, with President Vance coming back empty-handed, with the Iranian negotiators and the U.S. negotiators seemingly very far apart on core issues, including the future of Iran's support to its proxy militant groups across the region, and crucially, the nuclear program. So there wasn't any success there, but I think that there is hope that the talks can resume. Even J.D. Vance suggested that, even when the this 21-hour marathon negotiation that he led in Islamabad. So there's some hope that they could resume. I don't know that there's any cause for real optimism in the near term about the closing that gap, which is really significant in the positions of each side. But in the meantime, the U.S. military is now enforcing this naval blockade of Iranian ships and Iranian ports. So far, it's been quiet. Let's hope it stays that way. But there is the potential for escalation in the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf of Oman off of Iran.
Could you say more just about what exactly the U.S. is seeking at the table and why they think it's important and why they think they have any leverage over Iran to get those things?
Sure. Well, they would say the leverage is this control now that they are trying to assert of Iran's economy, which is already in very bad shape. But now the United States is saying, no, not only will we not allow you to export your oil, which is kind of the lifeblood of the Iranian economy. It sells a lot of that to India and China, in this dark fleet that it has. But we will not allow you to import anything. And that really is going to make conditions much more difficult for Iran. And that is the leverage that President Trump is seeking to exert over Iran's leadership. But honestly, the leadership has shown a pretty big willingness to endure pain, economic pain, and obviously military pain. It's not a democracy that needs to answer to its people in the same way that you would here in the United States. So I think there's a that is itself a reason for caution when thinking about the possibility of a short end to this conflict.
Yeah, and before we bring Molly into the conversation, I want to go back to the issue of the blockade. What does that really look like? Because when you hear the term blockade, a lot of us don't really know what that means. So what does that mean, in military and practical terms, and how is the impact felt?
So the blockade, there really kind of is a double blockade at this point. The Iranians for several weeks now have been trying to kind of play the same role that Egypt does in the Suez Canal, which is charging tolls and kind of overseeing the shipments that go through that waterway. It's very different in the Strait of Hormuz because that's an international waterway. Iran shouldn't be charging tolls, but that's kind of the first blockade that was in place, for the last several weeks now as part of the war that launched on February 28th. Now the United States has come in and said, no, we're actually going to do this additional layer of control, which is stopping Iranian ships from getting out of the ports. And crucially, there's kind of a difference of opinion when it comes to our discrepancy in what the blockade actually is between what President Trump on his Truth Social post on Sunday also seemed to suggest, or he said explicitly that the United States was going to kind of hunt down any ship that had paid a toll and to Iran and interdict them, which would be a whole different level of military operation. Right now, U.S. Central Command does not seem to be doing that. They seem to be conducting a more narrow mission, basically making sure that Iran can't export or import anything.
So I guess I'm just back to the what's at the table. Do you think that it's realistic for the U.S. to say we're going to get you to a position where you're going to agree to some timeline of not making a nuclear weapon or enriching more uranium, and you're going to do XYZ? Like, what's really the
I do think
conversation
there is
happening there?
the Iranians have shown some flexibility when it comes to slowing down their nuclear program. They did that in 2015 with President Obama's nuclear deal. I think that that is the area where there's the greatest cause for optimism. And so, there's been some reporting that they are kind of haggling over the number of years, anywhere between 50 and 20 years, that they would put a stop to their nuclear program. Clearly, the fate of their highly enriched uranium that they already have—they have these stockpiles that are sitting there that could be fairly quickly turned into something that would be able to be used in a bomb. That will be key. And then there's a whole host of other kind of more difficult issues, like their ballistic missile stockpiles and their support for groups that operate across the Middle East, like Hezbollah in Lebanon and other militant groups.
But this whole idea that there would be some regime change that the majority of Iranians may want coming to fruition, that feels like it's just slipping away further and further.
I feel like after the first few days of the conflict, really became something that was discarded as an objective for the president. He did promise to come to Iranian protesters' aid. And I think everybody in the administration would have been very happy if there had been, some democratic regime that came to power in Iran. But President Trump was never going to do very much to make that happen. And given that it didn't happen kind of spontaneously, I don't think he was prepared to act to make that happen. So he's kind of claimed victory and said that there is some sort of regime change, and kind of is trying to portray that as a success to his base. But I think that's a very basically an impossible case to make. The people who are now in control are harder line than the ones who were in control previously.
And so, Molly Ball, we want to bring you into the conversation because we hear what's happening overseas. But can we talk about the reaction at home, given these stalled negotiations, this blockade that's happening, failed initial goals for what was going to happen in Iran? What is the current status of the response from the American people and political forces on both sides of the aisle?
I mean, this is a war that has been unpopular with the American public since it began. And many of the president's critics, in particular, have pointed to what they would say is a sort of failure of the administration to bring the American people along and make the case as this war was being embarked on. And of course, the administration would say, you telegraph to the enemy, you lose the element of surprise when you do that, but the result has been that as this has gone on for 6 weeks now, what we increasingly see from the American public is not the traditional sort of rallying around the flag that happens when the American military embarks on a new conflict, but a sense almost of bewilderment. As Missy was saying, this war was launched with this idea that the Iranian people would take the opportunity to rise up and create a democratic government overnight, and clearly that has not happened. And so there's a lot of concern about sort of what the objective is. Now, Republicans are still largely behind President Trump and behind this war. Republicans in Congress also have, for the most part, been supportive with varying degrees of sort of caution or caveat. But again, in a situation where, we are in a midterm election year, this is an administration that was already facing a pretty difficult political environment. This is striking a lot of the especially Republican sort of strategists and so forth that I speak to as something that is only going to make their lives more difficult as the American people watch gas prices continue to go up and no end in sight.
And that's what I wanted to talk about because, President Trump has long treated gas prices as a political scoreboard. And, people are bracing. I mean, the gas is above $4, oil above $100 a barrel. And, Republican strategists are basically saying that politics could get really, really ugly if things don't come down. What are you hearing from folks as a response to try to stave off what could be a political windfall for Democrats coming up very soon?
Well, it's not that soon, right? It's April.
Yeah,
The
there's
election's
months
in
to go.
November. 11 minus 4 is 7. So we have 7 months until those midterm elections. And so I think, what the administration and its allies would say is, of course, the prices are going to spike when this artery is literally blocked, right? When you literally have a blockade on 20% of the nation's oil supply, even if it's not the principal source of American oil. But that is something that obviously cannot be sustained in the long term. And when some way of resolving that particular part of the stalemate is found, which, there's a lot of pressure on everyone involved, including the Iranians, to find a resolution just because that is such an important economic pathway. So I don't think anyone imagines that that could go on for months or years. And when the flow of oil is restored, then presumably those prices would come down. The problem for the administration is they can't say when or how exactly that's going to
And could it
happen.
really come down in just a matter of just a few months? Would it automatically come down, or could it take longer?
I mean, look, I'm not an economist, but certainly what we see as a pattern is that because oil is such a pure commodity and so responsive to pure sort of supply and demand forces, that these prices do tend to fluctuate almost instantaneously based on either disruptions to supply or the expectation of that.
And Missy, I'm curious how much of this, American domestic conversation are the Iranians aware of and know that that's part of their leverage, is that the American people will start to become less tolerant of this compared to, like you said, there it's a theocracy and they don't feel the same pressures, but here we do. And so when they're at the table with Americans, they know that, right?
Yeah, I think the Iranians are very close and astute readers of American politics and obviously the electoral timeline. And just to add to the question that you just asked, Molly, there are reasons why the price of oil is going to take a while to come down. There's been damage to oil facilities, natural gas processing facilities in the region, and that those are going to take years, months, and years to repair. So there's going to be kind of this lag that you're seeing in the rebound of the prices, even if there is a lasting resolution to the conflict. And hopefully that'll happen soon, but I don't think that that is going to, result in any sort of immediate situation. And President Trump is already acknowledging that, saying that gas prices may stay high into the midterms, which obviously is a bad sign for the GOP.
So why don't we move on to this kerfuffle, if that's the best word, between President Trump and Pope Leo. So over the weekend, basically, you had a Trump Truth Social post calling Pope Leo weak on crime, terrible on foreign policy, and then basically saying he wouldn't have been Pope if not for Trump. And the context was that Pope Leo has been very critical of the war in Iran, saying the day before that it was a delusion of omnipotence that is fueling the war. And then after Trump's comments Sunday, Pope Leo was interviewed and he had this to say.
I don't want to get into a debate with him. I don't think that the message of the gospel is meant to be abused in the way that some people are doing. And I will continue to speak out loudly against war, looking to promote peace.
So Molly, what do you make of this? What's the precedent here? How is this playing out?
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, there's some precedent, unsurprisingly, with Trump himself being in conflict with popes specifically, but in general, most presidents take care not to step on the toes of important religious figures in this way. This is a new pope, obviously the first American pope. Someone who a lot of American Catholics view with a great amount of pride. It's also the case that popes have for centuries seen their role as advocating for peace from a theological perspective, right? Not from a political perspective, although the Vatican is itself a state and popes do practice foreign policy. Trump is also someone who is famously not particularly tolerant of criticism, so perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that he would take this personally. But the level of personal abuse that he directed, at a figure who is quite literally seen as holy by his followers, is really stunning and remarkable, and has caused quite a bit of backlash. I think you have to put it in the context of the fact that, number one, this is a president whose base of supporters is overwhelmingly religious, and who is overwhelmingly supported by the most religious people in this country, Protestant and Catholic alike. It also comes in the context of, particularly politically, this sort of resurgence of Catholicism among a lot of the American right. People, up to and including the vice president himself, J.D. Vance, being drawn to and converting to Catholicism. And so to now have the leader of this church taking direct aim, if not by name, at the president and his policies is obviously something that Trump was annoyed by. But then to make it into this very political tit for tat of saying that the Pope is weak on crime is something that I think left a lot of people scratching their
Yeah, and I
heads.
know, Missy, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just like it, I think it is so striking to me that, the Pope isn't the one who kind of dragged religion into this war, or dragged the Catholic Church into the war. The administration has been citing Christianity and kind of a spiritual mandate for this conflict, and framing it in spiritual terms. And I think that is part of what Pope Leo is reacting to, because they're saying explicitly that they have God on their side. And that is very different than anything that I've covered as somebody who's been doing this for since the beginning of the global war on terror era. Obviously, that's something that, as the United States goes to war against a Muslim country, is an important part of the context.
Yeah, by the way, I want to invite you, our listeners, to participate in the conversation. Our question to you is, what news stories are you following most closely, and what are you most concerned about? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook streamers, you can put your comment in the chat. MJ on Facebook says, although I'm no longer Catholic, I am extremely proud of Leo. He's a great person. And so I wanted to zoom out a little bit, because another piece of religion, I mean, Missy, you raised that, this administration has brought religion into it. We got to talk about the image that was recently posted by President Donald Trump on Truth Social. It has him looking like a Christ-like figure with his hand out. There's light in one hand. He's wearing robes, laying hands on someone. He said that he was, thought of himself as a doctor. This is an AI-generated image. But there has been some backlash from a lot of Christians who felt like this crossed the line and that this is in fact blasphemous.
And then he deleted the post.
And then, by the way, the post was deleted, which is only the second time that he has deleted a post since he has been president in this administration. And so I'd love to get your thoughts on this, Molly, just sort of the reaction, not just to the fight with Pope, but also to this post that has since been deleted.
Absolutely. And I think you have to see the two together as number one, they're both part of this challenge that Trump is sort of frontally posing to his most religious supporters, almost daring them to be offended by his attacks on everything they hold dear. At the same time, you know, for as long as he has been in public life, as his base among evangelical Christians has only become more and more enthusiastic about him and sort of bonded to him, Trump has regularly done things that they might otherwise find offensive, almost as if he's sort of testing the boundaries of what he can get away with. I mean, the idea that this would not be recognizable as a sort of Jesus-like image is simply not plausible on its face. And anyone who would say that must never have seen Jesus before, right? So this is at the same time when you have, you know, a president who is posting all kinds of threats on Twitter, issuing ultimatums, using profanity. And so it adds up to this sense that the president is in this sort of chaotic and almost out of control mode. And you have very high profile supporters who've been very loyal to him, particularly in the sort of MAGA influencer space, increasingly expressing misgivings and expressing doubts about exactly what he's up to.
And I guess the big question, though, is like we've seen criticism for Trump on sorts of things that you could describe as erratic before. They come and go. They don't seem to have that much of a big political impact. Will this have that impact? I'll note that, you know, a Republican congressman from our area, Brian Fitzpatrick, wrote that the comments that Trump made about Leo were disgraceful, beneath the dignity of the presidency, and offensive to Catholics in every corner of the world. I reached out to another conservative Catholic source in the region who was more like, you know, we're still feeling this Leo guy out, and we think that Leo's comments were a bit over his skis, and we still support Trump. So it's interesting to see how that conversation will go. Do you have any insights on that, Molly?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that this is the pattern with Trump. This is what we've seen with Trump for 10 years. He creates a controversy, often by posting something on social media. And then, you know, it sort of burns through cable news and everyone expresses outrage, and then it's on to the next thing. And this is a sort of familiar cycle that particularly his most devoted followers have a lot of practice in taking his side in these sorts of conflicts and brushing off, you know, sort of Trump being Trump. Is there something unique about this? I mean, certainly some of Trump's, most loyal followers have still been troubled by these expressions of his. And I think what experience tells us is you're never going to see Trump's base of support fall off a cliff. Mm-hmm. He has this very devoted base of supporters. But certainly the political advisors around him believe that things like this don't help. And in politics, as is often said, is a game of addition, not subtraction. And you always want to be bringing people to your side, not driving them away. And so I think the question for those who would still like to see Trump succeed is sort of, why does he insist on creating these problems for himself that seem utterly gratuitous and that don't seem to make him any friends, even if they're not necessarily going to cause him to, spontaneously combust.
And we'll put a pin in it for right now. And we're going to be talking about some of the issues with the Department of Defense on the other side of this break. And we'd love to hear from you. What news stories are you following most closely? What are you most concerned about? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back with our guests after this break. This is Studio 2. Don't go anywhere.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here at WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCory in for Avi Wolfman-Arendt. This hour, we're digging into some of the biggest headlines this week, and we have two great reporters guiding us through. Let me reintroduce them. Molly Ball is the former Wall Street Journal senior political correspondent and the author of Pelosi. She's now working on a book about political realignment. And Missy Ryan is a staff writer for The Atlantic who covers national security.
And our questions for you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, is what news stories are you following most closely? What are you most concerned about? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our listeners on YouTube and Facebook, you can drop your comments in the chat. I'm going to read a couple comments. We have a listener on YouTube who says this war has probably made Iran want nuclear weapons more. They would be crazy not to try now. We have Ray, who says the war in Iran has had the effect of uniting the Iranians, exactly the opposite impact of what the Trump administration had hoped for.
So we were talking before that break about the spat with Pope Leo and what some people would describe as erratic behavior from the president. We had another example of that last week when he was posting about a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back, referring to Iran. And this is spurring some conversation in Democratic circles of, is this the time to reignite the conversation around the 25th Amendment, saying that Trump is unfit for office? Molly, if you're advising Democrats, is this a good idea or is it a distraction?
I am not a Democrat and not a political consultant. I do not give political advice. But look, the Democrats are caught between a rock and a hard place here because their base is so angry and so emotional and so upset about everything that the Trump administration is doing and desperately wants to see them doing something. And there is very little that they can do. They are the congressional minority. They can do, they have little bits of leverage, for example, when it comes to funding bills, with the result that the government is still not fully funded, for example, but they don't have a lot. And, they can make a lot of noise. They can try to influence public opinion. You certainly see them doing a lot of that. But short of that, sort of what is it that within the channels of sort of a hard power can be done? There is this amendment to the Constitution that provides for the president to be removed by the cabinet if he is judged to be incapable of fulfilling his responsibilities. This is something that was frequently discussed during Trump's first term as well. It is not going to happen. I think the president's cabinet is still fully behind him. They are not the ones that that this sort of discussion, at least now, is primarily coming from. It is the Democrats. And so there's another conversation going on about, do they try to bring another impeachment, particularly if they win the House in November, as many people expect will happen. And I think we will be hearing a lot about that as well. But, they're just in this very difficult situation. We saw with Trump's first two impeachments that they largely helped him politically. Democrats know that that's likely to be the case if they try it again. And yet they are under so much pressure to try to do something to hold him accountable.
Yeah, a lot of questions around accountability. And so we now want to pivot and talk about the Department of Defense and what's going on at the Pentagon. And Missy, we've been hearing a lot going on with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. People let go, people not promoted. We've also heard about orders and lawsuits related to how the Pentagon is treating with reporters. So there's three big stories there. And can we just go down the line and tick off all three? What's going on at the Pentagon?
Sure, there's a lot going on at the Pentagon. Pete Hegseth is the 10th Secretary of Defense that I've covered, and there is way more norm-busting behavior that is happening than anything I've experienced before. Hegseth, since coming in pretty much immediately since coming in, he has fired scores of top military officials, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was there, some service chiefs, the top lawyers in the military services, the first woman to lead the Navy. So there is a lot of desire to shake up what he calls, what he describes as like sort of calcified and kind of willful military brass. But there are also a lot of reasons to think that what he's trying to do is reshape it in his image, in his view of the military being overly woke and weak, and really prioritize loyalty over everything else. And so that has been, it's really straining the way the military works.
And so Missy, I wonder, are there concerns? Because I've heard that there are some concerns given the institutional knowledge that is no longer within the Pentagon and a critical moment when you see the U.S. engaged in conflict.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the military is still really big. You know, there are 1.3 million active duty service members. So there's still a lot of people there with experience. I think for me, it's more about what are the signals that you're sending in terms of the ability to dissent, the ability to flag downsides of any particular course of action, the ability to express opinions that are contrary to what you think the Secretary of Defense or the Commander-in-Chief might want to hear. And that, you know, can be applied to everything from the legality of, I think, boat strikes in the Caribbean or the wisdom of, you know, going into the war in Iran. And so I think that, you know, it's difficult to prove any sort of counterfactual, but I think that there are a lot of reasons to think that it's not a healthy environment that's being cultivated there.
Yeah, and I got to follow up and ask you about the issues with reporters there, because sure, there's been a lot of back and forth. There was a lawsuit, then an order telling the secretary that what he ordered was incorrect. Yeah. And so tell us where things stand with regard to reporters covering the Pentagon.
It's this ongoing legal saga. You know, most of the mainstream media refused to sign a new kind of set of guidelines last fall that would have, in our view, required us to kind of forswear the basic tools of reporting, asking questions. And so most of us had our credentials revoked and walked out of the Pentagon last fall. We lost the access that we got to talk to military officers and civilians on a day-to-day basis. You know, the perspective that we have is that this is something that is, you know, it in some ways it's a privilege, but also it's a duty to tell the stories of, you know, that these are taxpayer funded activities, and they are, it's not just, you know, these are the most, you know, weighty and consequential decisions that are being made with the lives of our young men and women. And so the media has a really important role to play there. The litigation is still ongoing, and so there's not a final resolution, but the courts have pushed back very hard on what Hegseth is trying to do with the media.
Another major news story this week, more international, is that Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has lost decisively to a former ally turned critic, Peter Magyar. I'm curious, do you think this is a sign of some larger backlash against strongman populism, or Orban was in office for 16 years and, of course, at some point he's going to be out of office? Like, could you help us unpack how that is playing out globally?
Yeah. Molly, do you want to jump in there?
Sure. I mean, it seems to be a bit of both, right? Now, I think you do have to remember that this was not necessarily a wholesale repudiation of Orban's political philosophy, given that it was a former ally who was his principal opponent here. So someone who also believes in a lot of the same sort of populist conservative policies. However, it was, as you said, Orban had been in power for 16 years. His regime was viewed as increasingly repressive and corrupt, apart from any of their sort of policy positions. And certainly the orientation of Hungary toward Putin rather than toward Europe and NATO and the West was something that was important and an issue during this campaign. And we have seen many in the MAGA movement seek to create this sort of populist international movement of right-wing populists, with Orban always being the sort of jewel in the crown, right? Orban and potentially Brexit in 2016, along with Trump, are the sort of principal accomplishments of this global populist movement, which figures like Steve Bannon have spent a lot of time and money trying to coordinate and make into a thing. So I think number one, you know, it's obviously a defeat for this administration, for someone like JD Vance, who actually traveled to Hungary to campaign for Orban in the final days of this election. But also it's a defeat for the sort of global vibes around white right-wing populism, right? When you have figures like Trump and Orban and many others around the globe and you know, right-wing movements or parties, particularly anti-migration parties, gaining steam across many European countries, as well as parts of Asia and South America. So when someone who had been as much of a symbol of that as Orban is defeated as decisively as he was, and despite you know the things he's done allegedly to erode Hungarian democracy, it really sends a very strong message, I think, globally about the fate of this entire
And
movement.
quick follow-up to you, Molly, because, you know, pundits have said this was less about a huge ideological shift than about economic stagnation, corruption, and the gap between propaganda and lived reality. How transferable are folks seeing this to what is happening here in American politics?
I mean, look, I think it's directly relevant because voters, in my view, are not nearly as ideological as the political class, but they want to feel that the government is making and seeking to make their lives better. And so they will tolerate a wide range of different beliefs and philosophies if they feel like you're getting the job done. When they feel like the government isn't getting the job done, whether it's coming from the right or the left, that's when you tend to see this kind of a popular revolt. So we now have a situation where a lot of people still think that Donald Trump or the Republican Party have better views on topics like immigration and the economy, but they don't see this administration delivering for them in a concrete way. They don't see it delivering on its promises, again, particularly where the economy is concerned, since that was so central to the 2024 election and has been so central to Donald Trump's political brand. So I think there's a direct political lesson from
And
what's happening.
Missy, your thoughts on how you think this changes the geopolitical chessboard in Europe and alliances with Russia or the West or NATO, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly good news for Ukraine. Hungary had been blocking some aid to Ukraine, some loans to Ukraine, and so it's good news for the people who had been worried about what happens when the United States steps back from assisting Ukraine. And it allows Europe to kind of come together more strongly in that gap, to fill that gap. And you know, for all the reasons that Molly just laid out, I think it also kind of underscores the strength of the kind of anti-incumbency feeling that we're, or anti-establishment, anti-incumbency feeling that we're seeing so powerful in so many countries across the world.
Yeah, we only have 3 minutes left on the show, but we had two members of Congress, Democrat Eric Swalwell of California and Republican Tony Gonzalez of Texas, recently announced that they're stepping down under two very different circumstances. I just wanted to get your take. You know, what do these exits tell us about the current political climate inside of Congress? Molly?
Not that different, right? They were both accused of sexual misconduct involving people around the members of their staffs. Obviously, there are differences in the details and in what they were accused of, but both quite serious allegations. There was at least some admission of impropriety. And they have both now resigned from Congress. So I guess what this tells us is there are still consequences in our political system occasionally, even if it can often feel like we are in a sort of age of impunity when political misbehavior is concerned.
Yeah.
And could we give you each a chance to shout out a story that you think is maybe underreported or under being listened to, watched, thought about right now? We'll start with you, Missy.
Yeah, I'm watching what's happening in Venezuela. There, you know, President Trump has actually been able to claim victory on several fronts there in terms of opening up the oil economy and avoiding a Iraq-style instability and chaos. But the democracy situation has not improved that much, and so there's going to be increasing pressure for him on that front.
And Molly?
Well, I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but Congress is back today after a two-week break, and the Department of Homeland Security is still technically shut down. Those TSA agents are at least getting paid thanks to an executive order, but we still do not quite have a roadmap out of this stalemate after nearly 2 months.
Wow. Well, thank you. Well, I want to say thank you both to Molly Ball, former Wall Street Journal senior political correspondent and author of Pelosi. She's now working on a book about political realignment. Also, thank you to Missy Ryan, who is a staff writer for The Atlantic, who covers national security. We appreciated both of your insights today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, and we'll read a couple comments. We have Jesse from South Philly who says, American interventions in foreign countries are ruthless. We destabilize, create a vacuum, sanction, they radicalize, and then we save the people. We are the baddies, babe. That's according to Jesse. Slow Food says, America's place in the world has been ceded to China. We have squandered goodwill with our allies and friends around the globe under Trump. We have set the planet back by possibly decades in terms of negative human impacts on the planet. That's Slow Food's comments.
Yeah, fascinating conversation today, yeah. Cherry, and we're so proud to be able to offer this show each and every day. And our show is produced by Debbie Builder and Hazel May Bryan. Al Banks and Mike Schiffler engineered today's show. I'm executive producer Kevin McCrory.
Yes, and I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for listening to Studio 2 today, and we look forward to seeing you tomorrow.